Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I am Carolyn Yeager, and it's a pleasure to be with you again on the Heretics Hour. I'm on live tonight, September 26th, as I always am now, and there will be an open phone line in the second hour of tonight's program. I have another new blog article up at Elie Wiesel Cons the World, which is at www.elieweaseltattoo.com. Somebody's got their line open, and I hear them typing in the background. That's not me. Okay, the title is of this new blog article is, Was Lazar Wiesel a Relative of Elie Wiesel? It follows directly from the three previous posts, which deal with any documented proof that Elie Wiesel was ever an inmate at Buchenwald. For your information, there is none. Elie Wiesel published a book in the United States in 1960 titled Night. This book is a fictional account of a boy named Eleazar and his father when they were interned at Auschwitz-Birkenau and Buchenwald concentration camps from May 1944 to April 1945. Well, the boy was there that long. The father supposedly died in February. Now, this short book of a little over 100 pages was based on a book written in Yiddish over twice as long, almost three times as long, actually, that was published in 1955 or 56, kind of started in 55, but actually says 56, in Buenos Aires, Argentina, the author of which nothing was known, being named Eleazar Wiesel. Now, you should know that there were a lot of Eleazar Wiesels in Eastern Europe at that time, some of whom are reported by family and friends to have been Holocausted, and then a lot, I'm sure, who weren't. Now, this book, Night, excuse me, wasn't put into the category of autobiography or memoir until it was picked up by Oprah Winfrey for her book club choice in 2006. Sending Night to the top of the New York Times bestseller list for nonfiction that year. The story officially became a true story overnight. This fictional book, Night, is really the only record of Elie Wiesel being at Buchenwald, and it is not any kind of record. That's why Elie and his important friends sought to identify him in the famous Buchenwald photograph, which contained a whole lot of unidentified inmates in a crowded barrack, some looking as if they had been starved almost to death. Now, I have talked about this photograph in depth several times, and the last on the blog previous to the one I'm now speaking, the one I just put up that I'm telling you about. And I showed that the inmate they identified as Elie Wiesel, they waited to do that until 1983. And this person cannot possibly be Elie Wiesel. I believe I have demonstrated that sufficiently well, and I'm waiting to see if anybody will come up with rebuttal that is worth anything, like perhaps Professor Kenneth Walzer. I do not expect they can. Yes, that's how confident I am. So I invite you to look at that article if you haven't done so yet. It's called Gigantic Fraud, having to do with Elie Wiesel Peace Prize, Nobel Peace Prize. But how bad is it, ladies and gentlemen, to impersonate a Holocaust survivor and to become a millionaire doing it and win the Nobel Peace Prize for it too? What should happen to a person who does that? Should the world say, Boy, isn't he clever? He fooled the whole world and got away with it. Or do the majority care? Or do the majority prefer not to know about it so as not to destroy their illusions? Or will they say, well, he didn't kill anybody like the Nazis did. He may have lied, but he didn't kill anybody. A lot of white European people will say that, even some people associated with BOR, possibly. Why are we so inclined to excuse the Jews, but not ourselves? The general attitude of most whites will be, even if Elie Wiesel were not incarcerated at Auschwitz or Buchenwald, still, his two sisters have records of being at Kaufering concentration camp near Dachau, where they worked in factories. We don't know what happened to his father and mother and little sister. They may have been murdered. We know that Elie was in France right after the war, so he was a refugee. Therefore, he was victimized by the German behavior toward the Jews, even if he wasn't in those two camps. But what about him saying that he was there? How much does that matter? How about him writing a book about it, or stealing someone else's book, or saying later that it was his personal story? What about claiming he's in that picture in the Buchenwald barrack? Don't all these lies really matter? Simon Wiesenthal has been revealed as a liar about most of his World War II Holocaust, I put that in quotes, quote, Holocaust, unquote, exploits. Yet he is forgiven and still admired because he supposedly kept public attention on Nazis who were hiding out from justice. Many Jewish so-called survivors have written books in which they confess that they helped in the claimed extermination, quote-unquote, of the Jews, because if they did not cooperate with their captors, they would have died sooner or been given a worse diet. And these ones survived afterward. Well, they are liars, too. But the morality of the World War II period is entrenched, and it goes like this. The Germans are the perpetrators, and the Jews are the victims. The Jewish media has been reinforcing that with impressive regularity and vehemence since 1930 at least. So that is 80 years now. So many of our white activists are afraid of the race issue and of the Hitler issue. They feel the need to tone their message down and to be on good terms with Jews and anti-racists. They can't bring themselves to say that the Nazis were the good guys, even if they were. The National Socialists were fighting against the Jews and Jewish power and the Jewish world banking monopoly in the interests of the white race. But today, those who say they represent white interests, some also say that they don't want anything to do with the German Third Reich. And if they do say something positive about it, it comes with huge disclaimers that they surely don't approve of Hitler in general. They prefer not to talk about it at all. The greatest regime in support of white interests that ever was. It is said that if Jesus Christ came back into the world today as an unknown, he would not be recognized as anybody special or anybody they really liked by 99.9% of Christians and probably actually rejected by 99%. Similarly, and I'm not trying to compare the two, but if Adolf Hitler was here again and not recognizable as such, he would be rejected by 99% of white spokesmen. This is because, in my opinion, we are a Judaized people living in a totally Jewish culture, and we need to be cleansed, decontaminated, and re-educated in order to be white people again. I think we don't know what it is to be white people, and we are not convinced that we have the right to be the people that we are. This is shown in the fact that most whites cannot be 100% for their own white people. 100%, I'm saying. Whites, even some of those who think they are the white leaders, have to repeat that they are not racist, that they have to talk about Semitic friends or Semitic celebrities that they happen to know and like. I'm saying this with the idea that this is totally unnecessary and really is not a good idea. They are the same. These people, these whites, say talk the same way with blacks and with Asians, with North and South American Indians, what have you. Many of them repeat that and insist that they're not a racist, but they just insist on white interests. Okay, I'll just say, and I'm not saying this in any way, I'm not picking out Stan Hess, but I did recently listen to his program from last week, and I did hear him say something that I wanted to comment on, and that is, and I don't have this in my notes, so I'm just hoping my memory holds up for me, that is that, now I did forget it already as soon as I started talking. All right, I believe that these habits, I'll go ahead and it'll come back to me in a second. I think these habits are so ingrained that we have to make a clean break from all that is non-white in our societies and communities, or we'll see the end of white and European and Aryan and some other names that we can use too. We'll see an end of all that. These are names we should be proud of, and we should speak of them proudly. Heck with what the others think. They're never going to think in our favor. Here are some results of our buying into the anti-racist belief system. And don't say, I'm going to give these examples here in a second. If I can remember what it was I wanted to say that Stan said, that was something to do with I really lost it. So sorry, sorry about that. And sorry, Stan, I will bring it up later on in the program because I know it'll come to me, or I can, it'll come to me, I'm sure. I don't mean to be saying anything against you. I'm just want to discuss a little bit a certain point. Now, I've got here an article from the Lewiston, Maine Sun Journal from James Sanchez. He sent this to a group, and I found it very interesting. I wanted to give him a little credit for it. But he just sent it to a group. He didn't send it to me particularly, but I like it. And this was published on August 11th, 2011. And it's about the Somalis. Now, Lewiston, Maine appears to be a liberal, white, very white place that has taken it upon itself to mix its population as much as it can. And it has invited a lot of Somalis to come and live there. And these Somalis, when they come, it's my understanding that they get a lot of government, federal government, I'm sure, money to put them up in housing and for them to buy food and for them to have a car often and for them to just about have everything. They don't even need to work if there's, they're just supported because they are refugees from some kind of civil war there. Well, at the Lewiston Middle School, students and two adult organizers are behind the, some fundraisers that they hope will benefit drought-stricken Somalia, where they say, and they're teaching the kids, that tens of thousands of children have died there. Now, I'm pointing this out because, I had just said that we should not, we don't need to have friends or talk about not being racist or insist that we get along with everyone. And I wish I could remember exactly what Stan said so I could finish that off. But it has something to do with our attitude, continuing to be open to non-white people, even though we're looking out for our own interests. I know what it is now. Okay. He was saying that we have a right to our own interests, so to speak. He was talking about hate speech. That's it. He was saying that that these non-whites use hate speech against whites, and he finds that really, really bad. And he says we should speak out and tell them we don't want them to use these hate words to us. we have a right to not have hate speech used against us, just as they have that right. Now, I find this to be, you know, I get down into the details pretty well. I realize that. But when I hear something like that, I find that to be, that's not the way we want to put it. Why do we want to agree that hate speech is a bad thing and say, well, we're not going to use hate speech. You shouldn't use hate speech. And that puts credibility into what is called hate speech. Why do we, you know, we should not care what words they call us, and we should not care, what they think of what we say to them. All this concern, these little sensitive feelings about words. You know, we all know the childhood rhyme of sticks and stones can break my bones, but names can never hurt me. Kids resort to that a lot because they do call each other names all the time. And we've all probably had our feelings hurt when we were children by somebody calling us a name or saying things about us. And kids just do this among one another. Not that I am recommending that we call non-whites bad names, or that we would even encourage them to call us bad names, but I don't care. And I don't think we should care. And I don't think that speech should be monitored, and that we should ever go along with the whole idea that hate speech is something that has to be stomped out or stopped or criticized or even made real. I was watching a video news program last night on the computer, and from the past, sometime earlier this year. And it was on there was a black woman who was the president of the NAACP in her city, a kind of a southern city. And she was talking about some whites that behaved badly, she thought, and she didn't want them to be coming back to the city. And she said, oh, no, you know, they bring this hate with them. And she was a very sweet-looking lady, very light-skinned, but definitely black, very black, very African-American features, Negro features, and in her speech and so forth also. And she used the word hate several times, and she only talked a little bit, but her whole thing was that these whites were full of hate, or they used hate speech, and they brought hate, and we don't want any hate around. This is their thing, you know. This is how they want to remain parasites on us, by accusing us of hating them from all the way back to the very beginning of we ever laid eyes on them, and being hateful toward them. And they're never going to let that go. And all other non-whites do the same thing against whites, that whites are hateful. We're all about hate, and they use that. We should not use it in return, because then we're begging them. Sometimes it sounds, when I hear someone say something the way Stan was saying it, that sometimes it sounds like we're saying, oh, please, let us just have our rights like you have your rights here. We have become reduced in our own nations to asking for the same rights that these non-white people who have did not found the nation and did not build the nation, although they like to pretend they did, have been raised up, are now enjoying. You know, and if we don't go along with that, then it's because we are hateful. Now we're going to find something in here as I go along about this hate. I'm glad I remembered that. I'm done with that now. It says, okay, we're back to Lewiston, Maine, and this program for the Somalis. There's a Somali female named Zam Zam Muhammad who lives in Lewiston. And she is the one who has started this, instigated this program for this kids, along with this teacher. Couldn't have done it by herself, but she has been raising the issue in saying that these Somalis are dying because of starvation and they need help. Well, you know, Somalis, if you have seen pictures of these Somalis, where they live and how they live, they live in a very dry place. And I'm not going to get into the oil issue, which may have something to do with some of it, but there's droughts and famines there regularly. And there have been, no doubt, through the ages. And when that happens, they don't do anything about it because they don't know what to do about it. They have never done anything about anything. They're just there, and whatever comes along, they deal with it. And so when these famines come along, I think they did die off, a lot of them. And that's how, because they're very, very high, they have a high breeding rate, that's how they keep in balance with the place where they live. Now, why do they live there? Well, it's kind of like a hellhole, but I guess that's where they end. That's the people they can't go anywhere else because nobody else, the other places have taken up. So this is all that's left for them. And I guess maybe they've been there maybe for ages and ages. So, but they are, in my opinion, they are close to the animals that live there, because it's like when droughts and things like that occur, terrible weather problems, and the food dries up, animals can't do anything about it. They don't do anything about it. They just die. And then they get back to a smaller ratio, and then they can start, when things get better again, then they start breeding more, and they build up their numbers again until they have too high a numbers, generally, and then the same thing will happen again. And this has been the cycle of nature forever. Now, it's the same way with these Somalis, probably. Now, I know I sound probably terrible to a lot of people, but I'm not going to adjust my speech in order to please people on these issues. Because if we prevent these people from dying from famine, and they are evolved, they are evolutionarily genetically set up now to have high breeding rates. They will just breed if we keep them alive and move them to different parts of the world and take care of them. There is no point in this. There's no purpose in it. So we really have to face facts. But now Zamzam in Lewiston is getting all these sympathetic white people who do want to serve the African interests say, oh, we can't allow these people to die. And so let's see what we can do about it. So she got together with the Lewiston Middle School's Pamela Erickson. Now, this Pamela Erickson is a teacher of English language for non-English speaking, you know, the English language learners. She's teaching the Somalis English, because she's not teaching English to the American kids who know how to speak English. And so they, you know, what do they do in this English language class? They're reading A Long Walk to Water, a book about Sudan. That led them to talking about Somalis. And then they talked about how things were back home. So this is not contributing to these Somalis becoming Americans. They're not being thrown into a real American situation and being forced to behave like Americans. No, they are being catered to and learning about their homeland, Somalia, and thinking about that and how they can help all the people back there. Now, another thing is that these students have been given, they give them enrichment programs, and they have an after summer camp program. And during this summer camp that they were given, and they worked out this program where they would do some redeem bottles and things like that, recycling and so on, to raise money for the drought. But they're going to raise money only for the Somalis. There's three nations, the Kenyans and the was that the Sudanese and the Somalis are all starving right now, but only these Somalis only want to help the Somalians. And their goal is $2,000. They don't think, they're not sure they will reach that goal with what they're doing, but that's their goal. Now, what is $2,000 going to do against this huge problem in Somalia? It's not going to do anything. So what is the purpose of all this? The purpose, it seems to me, is to get all these American kids worked up over an American people in Lewiston, because they're asking the whole community to chip in and help out with this, to get Americans to be concerned with Africa. And this is just a good example of what I'm saying, how we get roped in to things that are not in our interests, that don't do us any good. And instead of taking care of Americans, we're doing this. All right, when I come back, ladies and gentlemen, I have a little more on this and I'll some more things to say. So stick with me and I'll be back in 5 minutes.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Now, Palestinian officials have accused the U.S. of putting pressure on members of the U.N. Security Council to keep them from voting in favor of a free Palestine. Analysts say that Washington is keen to be spared the embarrassment of having to veto the bid, which would be disastrous for its credibility as a peacemaker. RT's Marina Portnaya has more on the political complexities of the case.
It was a week-long gathering of the world's most politically powerful people.
The heart of the United Nations. The pursuit of peace in an imperfect world.
America's Nobel Prize-winning president set an ideal tone as the 66th session of the UN General Assembly opened. Yet at the heart of almost all diplomatic dialogue, demonstrations, and media attention was the Palestinian pursuit of official UN membership.
At a time when the Arab peoples affirm their quest for democracy, the Arab Spring, the time is now for the Palestinian Spring, the time for independence.
Supported by the majority of UN member states, President Mahmoud Abbas submitted an application for statehood, a historical bid the U.S., a staunch ally of Israel, vowed to block with a Security Council veto.
Peace will not come through statements and resolutions at the United Nations. If it were that easy, it would have been accomplished by now.
As diplomats worked round the clock to bring Israel and the Palestinians back together at the negotiating table, delegations for 30 countries abandoned the Iranian president during his speech to the General Assembly.
If some European countries still use the Holocaust after six decades as the excuse to pay fine or ransom to the Zionists, should it not be an obligation upon the slave masters or colonial powers to pay reparations to the affected nations?
Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's annual attack against the West and Israel was a reminder that
peace is hard, but we know that it is possible.
A possibility for the Palestinians and Israelis to resume negotiations was put forth by the Middle East Quartet Friday. Russia, the U.S., the European Union, and the U.N. presented both sides with a 12-month timetable to solve the 60-plus-year dispute.
Within 3 months of the negotiation beginning, to present comprehensive proposals on borders and security. That is the only way, in the end, we deal with the difficult issues around the table in a negotiation.
The UN General Assembly was this week's biggest political show, a spectacular display of pride for the Palestinians, a, quote, theater of the absurd for the Israeli Prime Minister. The Security Council meets Monday to discuss the Palestinian bid for UN membership. As the quest for peace goes on, divisions over how to achieve it remain firmly in place. Marina Portnaya.
Thank you.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. And I do apologize if I don't if it sounds to anybody like I'm talking against another VOR host, which I'm not doing. I think a lot of the people at VOR, and I just wanted to use that particular instance there as a good example. Now, I was talking about this article in the Lewiston, Maine Star Ledger or whatever it is about the Somalis, and there was a comment to this article of this school group that's working on this, and they want to get the whole community involved. Now, this comment, only one comment that when I looked at it, and this commenter said, "This is just the hardcore reality." And I asked that the people of the Twin Cities do not turn a blind eye. I guess Lewiston is a twin city. But I ask, this is the hardcore reality, but whose hardcore reality? We're talking about Somalia in Africa. Is that our reality? You see, should we fall into that trap that, oh, the reality of the world, from a humanist perspective, that we should all have, is that all these people in Africa are suffering, as they always have been, time and again, here and there, now and then, you know, from nature, and other places in the world, that this is their reality, and it's supposed to be our reality too. We're supposed to take on this reality for ourselves and do something about it. No, you know, we have lost sight of our own reality. There is no white people's reality except as we see it now through the lens of non-whites. And mostly Jews have engineered this. Only Jews could have engineered it. But they've got all the others on board, and they're getting pretty savvy about it too. So, you know, simple things like this I look at and I object when they say that I'm supposed to see this as reality. Then it said, this commenter says, we need to take back a sense of what community means. And not only that, but show how much we do care and blah, blah, you know. Community? Is that our community, Somalia? Are the Somalians our community? Do they come here and redefine what our community is? You see, this is not small stuff. This is how it works, how it happens. This is how we get sucked into forgetting about ourselves and thinking we shouldn't care about ourselves. Because here's the thing, when you contrast yourself as an American with people in Somalia who are way, way, way down on the scale of achievement and expectations in life, you know, standard of living, and always have been, we can't compare ourselves with them, and we shouldn't, but we're doing it. And so people will say, Americans and Europeans will say, well, look how well off I am, even if I am undergoing all this distress in the world today with our economy, even if our own world is really crummy and falling apart, I'm still so much better off than these people wandering around there in the, looks like always in the hot sun with no trees or anything, and living in some tent communities that have been set up for them. So I should help them. You know, we should not be comparing ourselves with these people. They live on the other side of the world in a totally different environment, and they have never done anything except what they're doing now, which is to just live and eat and breed. And they have never created anything that I know of. So we should not be saying, you know, if we're bad off, we need to look and do something about it. We should not be thinking, well, I might be having troubles, but I don't have such bad troubles as they have. We never will have such bad troubles as they have. We will never be on the same level as they are. So this commenter says, Somalia needs us. They need a lot of us. Don't turn a blind eye, says again. Somalia needs us. Too bad. Somalia needs us. Somalia is going to have to take care of itself. If Somalia probably can't do anything for itself right now, but Africa has to take care of Somalia. And if Africa can't do it, then that's what they are. That's who they are, and that's what they have to live with. It's not our job to take care of them. Now, on this newspaper, after this comment, in their comment section, they have their policy. And they have they say our policy prohibits comments that are, one, defamatory, abusive, obscene, racist, or otherwise hateful. Well, I'm paying attention to the last part there. You cannot write a racist comment. Well, anything that I might say, or some of you might say, or anything that you'd say that might be clear and truthful about the situation would be considered racist by their standards. And then they say racist or otherwise hateful, meaning that racist is already hateful. To be racist is hateful, and any other thing that would be hateful would be prohibited. And then they have excessively foul and or vulgar. So foul and or vulgar, I guess, is okay, but not if it's excessively foul and vulgar. And inappropriately sexual. So sexual might be all right, but not if it's inappropriately sexual. So now, who decides what's inappropriate, what's excessively, and so on, and otherwise hateful? Well, the newspaper people do. So you don't have a chance if you want to really say anything there. Now, James Sanchez sent another little item about Lewiston that is this along the same lines. It has to do with the same thing, the Somalis. I guess there's a lot of them in Lewiston. And here's this thing where one Lewiston Somali, he says, this was in another article, I guess. One Lewiston Somali mentioned in an interview on CBS News that Americans, well, he says who are not subservient, Americans who are not willing to help Somalia are hate people. You know, this is how they talk. That's why I wanted to bring up that thing from Stan about the hate. Because they're going to call us hate. They're going to use this word hate now. And they're going to try to pass more and more laws about hate. And it's no point. There's no point in us worrying about whether they're calling us hate words. The only thing we should be doing is trying to get our people united and take some control over the government and control over what's being done in this country and in European countries. Now, listen to this. The ex-mayor, I don't know if this young woman called Kira was the ex-mayor, but that's what it says. Anyway, a young woman called Kira decided to take, she announced that she had found an amazing and wonderful dream job, which was 3 years as a rape counselor in a Sierra Leone women's refugee camp. Now, can you imagine an American woman, young woman from Maine, is going to take a job, and she thought this was a dream job because she could go and help these women in this refugee camp in Sierra Leone as a rape counselor. And these women were being raped all the time. And some of them had, you know, were really being all torn to pieces by this Revolutionary United Front. But anyway, on top of this, she was going to take her 8-year-old son with her. And I guess she did, because she came back very quickly and she did not want to talk about it. She wouldn't talk about it. Well, this is what I read. I can't verify this, but this is how our white people are. Well, we know this. They want to go and help the most, the lowest and the most lost and hopeless people in the world. And they think that they're going to make a difference. Well, she came back and she wouldn't talk about what she found there. All right. Well, I want to Well, I've used up a lot of time, but I have another hour. And I want to remind you that you can call in the second hour. The number is 1-855-477-2283. And if no one calls, I have plenty of things here to say, but I hope to hear from some of you. Now, I have an email. I got quite a few good emails, but the one I'm going to really go into is from Haas in Denmark. He wrote me some very good stuff, and I'm going to read from some of it. Not all of it. I've cut parts of it out because it's too much. You know, it's too long. But I'm just going to say that he says, "Dear Carolyn, I agree with you that the question of race is the predominant problem of our time. If or when our white race gets spoiled by mixing, and the constant immigration is doing the mixing increasing, making the mixing increasingly doable for many young folks, then everything will be lost." And then after a few other words, he says, "Like you, I am puzzled by the idiotic stance of Norwegians." Now, I don't want to pick on Norwegians. I know a Norwegian who got very angry at what I said about the children, the German-Norwegian children. And I said the Norwegians were crazy. But he says that he agrees. He's in Denmark. He says he's puzzled by the Norwegians. He says, "I do know them well. Have worked in Norway on many occasions. These are very intelligent and industrial people, but they do not get it." Now he goes on to say, "Talking with Norwegians or Swedes about the realities of race is not an easy undertaking. The more intelligent ones are quite aware of the problem and know very well that the darker races are very different from the Northern Europeans." Now, I want to just insert here that, you know, I hope you realize that the Norwegians and the Swedes are taking in a lot of Africans into their countries. They don't have the number that we have here in the United States, but it's a lot for them, and they have never had them there before. And it's really quite a phenomenon, really. So Haas goes on to say, "The main difference is not even that of pure intellect, that is the difference between the non-whites and the Northern Europeans, is not even that of pure intellect, but that of mental and physical laziness. Northern man is a born builder and creator. Southern man is a destructor and consumer." Well, this is Haas now. You don't blame me for what I'm reading here. "He will rather use his energy on cheating and avoiding work instead of do something of durable value. But even in Sweden and Norway, not to speak of Denmark, there are lots of Jews who are influential in media. They, quite apart from the inborn or cultural antipathy to think about race and the obligatory but misunderstood humanitarianism, poison the political discourse in these lands. In Sweden, the greatest press conglomerate is in Jewish hands." He says it's the Bonner family. Then he talks a little about Poland. I wasn't going to read this, but I'll read it real quick. "Poland is in this respect an interesting place. There is a racial mixture of Germanic and Slavic blood where the latter predominates, the Slavic. Were it not for the Germanic element in Poland, Poland would not have been quite economically, I think he means quite as economically successful a country today. He says, "I'm not comparing it with Germany, for it is impossible. Any country except a few of similar blood plus Japan, Korea will be inferior to Germany in the way of economic success and industriousness." He says, "It helped a lot in transition from communist economy to the present one that Polish farmers have been private throughout the communist times. People did not forget what it means to drive a private firm." And he says, "Also, many people, not least Germans, like to come to Poland and enjoy streets devoid of Arabic or Turkish faces. Poland is still 100% European, and I like it too when I come there." Well, I know that Haas does stand up for Poland because he did that with me back when I had some programs where he thought I was too hard on the Poles in Poland, and he was rather critical of what I was saying. So he's not being critical of the Poles, but he certainly is being complimentary toward the Germans here. Now he says, this is what I want to read to you. He says, I have just read the memoirs of Joseph Beck's private secretary in 1937-39, whose name is Powell Straczynski. It has not been translated to any languages, which is a pity. He describes, I think Haas reads a few languages. He describes very beautifully the process of encircling of Germany in 1938-39. It was done, apart from purchased politicians like Churchill, mainly by a press campaign, not only in Britain and other Western countries, but also in Poland, where most of the press was in Jewish hands already. The press campaign against Hitler and Germany was being driven increasingly and worked up to an anti-German hysteria. When Beck was to London to sign a treaty, he was being feted by crowds in the streets as a hero. The same in Poland. The press was responsible for the atmosphere of tension, fear, hysteria, and hatred against Germany. By June, July 1939, it was clear that the war was coming. Maybe Hitler did not know it yet, he says, but the man on the street did because of the press. Well, this is what's bothering him. He says, it is very sad to read today when Jewish power over media and thus over people's minds is even greater than then. I enjoy and salute people who, gives some names, obviously he means stand up to this, but he says, but realistically, good people and good patriotic information is not dominating. I agree. But back to Haas, and even within the alternative media, you have creatures like Gordon Duff. Well, he agrees that Gordon Duff is disinfo and bad for us. All right. Now, he sent me a second email, and he said some things that I thought were important. And he says, Sweden would be an example. He says, in my humble opinion, race is everything. In this, I am in 100% agreement with Hitler. But he's never really sounded like a big Hitler fan, but now he's kind of partway. He's in agreement with Hitler on this. Of course, even with the best racial composition, something may go wrong. He said Sweden would be an example, a pure Nordic blood. Until recently, they have been a success for a long time, never conquered by anybody. Gave birth to a Russian Empire and other countries, possibly Poland. I do believe that I know that Poland was under Swedish rule for a while. They destroyed the Khazar Empire, won the 30 Years' War. After the Industrial Revolution set in, they became producers of highest quality machines, arms, cars, even furniture. But a little, quite recent admixture of Jews was enough to brainwash them to death. They opened their borders for hordes of Arabs, Turks, Kurds, and Pakis. Well, this is what I've said, that these far northern Europeans have seemed to have very little resistance to the argument that they are racist or bad if they don't share all that they have created for themselves with dark-skinned people from who are poor and don't have anything like that. And they haven't seemed to didn't seem to figure out why they didn't have it and that they weren't going to be helpful at all in Sweden. But now, Haas says, they are, as a society, a wreck. All right, let's pay attention here. There's no real cohesion, all right? Don't we all experience that in our nations? Everybody is compelled to be 100% politically correct, and the result is that there is no discourse, no deep political conversations. People just shut up, like in Stasi times in the DDR. With the difference that they are policing one another. Then he says, talking about the Swedish welfare state, which is what we have, especially in Europe, what they created, and then started bringing in foreigners to take advantage of it. He says, the Swedish welfare state was the best in the world, but the problem is it was created for people with Swedish mentality. That is, no cheating, no corruption, no staying at home for weeks on sick leave. You don't even have to show a doctor's certificate to show that you have a right to be on sick leave. And the doctor's certificates are free anyway. You don't have to pay for them. And your word is enough, he says. I can believe that the Swedes can do this. He says, and you are getting 100% of your normal pay. Then he says, Arabs are using the system liberally, and now it is falling apart. Besides, despite the best of Nordic genes, the youth are totally different from the previous industrious generations, same as in Denmark and Norway. TV, movies, music cause them to be eternally immature, clueless, demanding from others and not themselves. Well, this is our Judaized society. As we become more, as our culture becomes more and more Judaized, and just about everything in popular culture comes from Jews and is by Jews, then that's what they're doing to our people, to our youth. The liberal Jewish pedagogy makes it impossible to demand anything from the youth. And they are not, of course, able to self-discipline themselves. Well, Stan was talking about this last week, too. Same thing. So he says still, he says he'll choose a Danish or Swedish nurse. Maybe he's a doctor to help me and not an Arabic one. Well, I don't know. I can understand that, too. I'm going to move forward here a little bit. Anyway, he's simply saying that, and then he goes into why. He says he thinks that the Scandinavian or Northern European character makes us extremely vulnerable to this Jewish ideological poison. And a big role in this racial self-hatred was played by the Holocaust. But he says that this started long before World War II, so that can't be the reason for it. And he says that he's kind of pessimistic because he just read that book by Beck's secretary. And he says it is really incredible how quickly and effectively war hysteria and anti-German hatred was produced out of nothing by a well-prepared press campaign. You know, he says neither the Brits nor the Poles could do much facing the hysteric public opinion. So if you were one of the more sensible ones and you didn't want to go along with all of that, you really couldn't do anything about it. So we need to see. I think from this, it's the point of all this is that a little bit of non-white entry into our cultures, into our nations, has led to more and more and more. So we cannot tolerate, I'm going to begin arguing, that we cannot tolerate even a little bit. And this is where we have to come down very stern, and it's going to be very hard, and people aren't going to want to go along with it, that the solution is nothing but our white people, nothing but our white culture. And we have plenty of bad white people. I know that. It's not about good people and bad people. It has to be according to race in order for us to organize and function together in a way that we need to be able to do. Now, I need to add in here before this hour ends that I got an email from Dennis Fetcho, who I mentioned either last week or the week before. Last week it was. I got another person emailed me that he was Jewish and he was new on the Oracle broadcasting system. And he emailed me telling me he wanted to come on my program and talk about himself, but I didn't want to invite him on the program. But I told him I would reply. I would say, I would tell my listeners what he had to say about it. And I asked him, I said, we want to know whether you're Jewish and we want to know why you're doing or wanting to do a radio program, something you've never done. And now you are. And he turns out his whole thing is about occultism. He says he's a Kabbalist. He studies the esoteric and occult constructions in the English language. I don't think I would like any of that. He says his work is opposed to the Kabbalah, but he's a hermetic Kabbalist, and on about his insight into the occult and so on. And this is what he talks about in his program. But you know what? He says all this. He says, I should check my sources. I should have called him and asked him about himself and so on. But he does not answer whether he's Jewish or not. That's what I asked him first. And he has not said. So I find that to be something that's missing that he should have cleared up. Now, I have another little thing here, if I have time for it, about Eleanor Roosevelt. This I remember. I don't think I have time for it. Let's see. No. And I want to remind you that you can call in now, and the number is 1-855-477-2283. Friends, I'd love to hear from you. So if anybody has been waiting to call, do so now, and we'll get together on the other side of this.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
FSN, I'm Kate Moody with the latest world news. Pro and anti-Gaddafi forces are fighting near the former Libyan leader's birthplace of Sirte, one of the last remaining strongholds of Gaddafi loyalists. The provisional government's troops were backed by NATO warplanes as they approached the eastern outskirts of Sirte. Muammar Gaddafi's whereabouts remain unknown, although several of his children and members of his inner circle have fled the country. Meanwhile, the National Transitional Council has asked the United Nations to lift international sanctions against Libya. De facto Prime Minister Mohamed Jibril said as much as $110 billion worth of Libyan assets was frozen while the Gaddafi regime was still in power.
We raised some remarks in the Security Council regarding our request to unfreeze our money according to the resolution 1973 of the Security Council. We made the specific request that the objective circumstances based on which that resolution was taken are not there anymore, so there is no need for that resolution to be applicable anymore.
The largest haul of precious metal ever found at sea has been discovered on a shipwreck in the Atlantic. 150 million pounds sterling, or $232 million worth of silver, has been found on the SS Gersoppe, a UK cargo ship sunk by Germany in 1941. The lion's share of the spoils goes to a private company, as Ollie Barrett reports.
The wreck of the 412-foot ship was only found a few months ago, 300 miles off the Irish coast, and was not confirmed as SS Gersoppe until last week. The ship settled upright on the seabed, which will make retrieval of the bullion possible. Merchant Navy vessel SS Gersoppe was on its way back to Britain from India in 1941 when it was sunk by a German U-boat. Only one of the 85-strong crew survived. The ship was found by US exploration firm Odyssey Marine, who will now retain 80% of the cargo's value under the terms of the contract they signed with Britain's Department of Transport. Ollie Barrett, London.
Russian Finance Minister Alexei Kudrin has resigned after a public row with President Dmitry Medvedev. Mr. Kudrin has been praised by foreign investors for his handling of the Russian economy, as Anya Ardaeva reports from Moscow.
During his visit to the United States, Russian Finance Minister Alexei Kudrin said he would not serve in a new government next year if, as expected, Dmitry Medvedev becomes prime minister. The two men have long been at disagreement over budgetary policies, with the finance minister criticizing the president's plan to increase military spending. Russian President Dmitry Medvedev has publicly ordered him to resign, saying his comments were, quote, improper and can in no way be justified. Mr. Kudrin responded by saying he would consult with Prime Minister Vladimir Putin first, a humiliating statement for Mr. Medvedev, who is often seen as Vladimir Putin's political puppet. Anya Ardaeva, Moscow.
This is FSN.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is our call-in hour now, and we do have a caller or two on the line, and we're going to start out with Frank. Hello, Frank.
Hello, Carolyn. How are you this evening?
Well, I'm just fine. It's nice to hear you. Thanks for calling in.
I just wanted to take a minute to commend you on what a fine job you're doing. I've been listening to your show ever since it's come on, and you really bring an enlightened perspective to the whole topic of Germany and World War II, and everything that you present, you have it footnoted so well. And for anybody that listens to this any length of time, the pieces all start to fit together. And little by little, I think there is a new awareness of maybe the misdirection that we've all been led into the last 60 years. So I don't want to tie up too much of your time. I wanted to call you a couple of times and just commend you what a great job you're doing. Keep up the good work.
I thank you. I always like to get a call like that, Frank.
Okay.
Thanks very much. All right.
Have a great evening.
Thanks. Bye. So long. Yeah, I think Frank was one of the first people that when I did my first show here on VOR, and right away there were some comments on my page, and that's when we had comments still. I think Frank was the first one, as I recall, to write and congratulate me on my program. So I'm glad to hear he's still listening. Is there another caller on the line? No? Well, let's see. I should look. There was one, but I guess they dropped or something. So the phone number, ladies and gentlemen, is 1-855-477-2283. So call in. Now, I have this item here about Eleanor Roosevelt. This came from James Sanchez, too. He said he went to a library sale during last weekend, and he bought this book by Eleanor Roosevelt for $2 called This I Remember. You know, eventually I ended up looking it up on the, okay, I have a caller, but I'm going to wait just to, I'm just going to do this little short item here, finish it, and then I'll take the caller. This book is very expensive on Amazon, but it's old. It was published in 1949. It's 379 pages with a 25-page index. Eleanor Roosevelt writing about the war, you know, her life with Franklin and the whole, mostly during the war. And in it, and I checked the index too, she doesn't mention the Holocaust. She doesn't mention, she doesn't have Jews in the index under Jews. She doesn't have refugees in the index. She doesn't have any of the camps. She doesn't mention Auschwitz or Birkenau or Dachau or Buchenwald or Bergen-Belsen or anything like that. She doesn't mention the Nuremberg War Crimes Trials. She does have, she has a whole lot of pages, a whole lot about Roosevelt's of every stripe. But she does mention the Morgenthau Plan. And she gives, she has five footnotes to that. And she had quite a few footnotes for Churchill and a few things like that. But she doesn't, so she goes into the same category with Winston Churchill, Eisenhower, and de Gaulle, who wrote their big books, their memoirs after the war. And they never mentioned anything about gas chambers, concentration camps, or Holocaust in them. Kind of strange. She does talk about Adolf Hitler, five pages on Hitler, and two of those pages also include Benito Mussolini. But she doesn't talk about National Socialism, but she does spend eight pages on the New Deal. So there you go. All right, let's see. What is your name? Are you still there, caller? Please tell me who you are.
Is it me, Carolyn?
Yes, whoever.
Oh, this is Steve from California.
Oh, hi, Steve.
Hi, how you doing?
Well, I'm doing fine. Nice to hear from you.
Yeah, this is a record for me, two weeks in a row. I normally don't call.
No,
shows, you know. Sometimes I'd rather listen, you know, sometimes. But, you know, I felt that I needed to call, you know. Because,
okay.
You know, the article that I sent you, you know, that about the, you know, those articles about the Holocaust survivors that, you know, they amount to, like, tall tales and fairy tales and, you know, that one that involved that woman that the title was From Holocaust Survivor to Playboy Bunny. You know, and I just thought very odd that,
she was a weird one. I mean, these things get highly ridiculous, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, how can you walk 600 miles in the freezing cold with improper shoes or no boots and no coat and not suffer from frostbite? I mean, first of all, to walk 600 miles is rather...
Well, none of them walk 600 miles, yes.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this goes back to what I was saying, that we've been so this idea that the Jews suffered enormously, you know, and there's nothing they can come up with about their suffering that people aren't ready to believe, you know, no matter how incredible and gigantic it is, and that the Germans are always the perpetrators.
Right.
And this is just, people are just ready to accept this, and they want to hear it that way too. Unfortunately.
Well, you know, I found another, I suspect it's false because I actually kind of traced it to, you know, I mean, it's probably in many articles. It's supposedly a quote about Hitler, Himmler, where he said basically, now it was posted on Keith Hurt's chatboard. It says, we had the duty to our people to do it, to kill this people who wanted to kill us. Himmler. So one of the first articles that I found was actually on a website called rationalwiki.org. And it's basically, it leads into, it's tied to a story, Holocaust denial story, you know, article. So, I mean, that's where you find it. It's like we have the moral, and it's worded a little bit different. Just to show you, like, you know, these things.
Well, I think it's possible.
Someone will say kill, destroy.
Yeah. Well, you know, Himmler did say something like that, I think. But he was talking about Himmler. Yeah, didn't you say Himmler?
He
was talking about the resistance fighters who were really the... the guerrilla fighters in Russia, in the Soviet Union, they were doing terrible things to the Germans. And they were killing them. And they were not in uniform, and they were this and that. And they had the order that when they caught these people, to just execute them. They were supposed to have they had the right to execute them because they were fighting illegally against them and killing them and maiming them and so on. But at the same time, you're supposed to, I understand, have some kind of a military court there, you know, some kind of a process. But they were sort of dispensing with that process, which would have been pretty much, it would have been the same in the end anyway, you know. But it just took up too much time, and they were fighting this war, and they, you know, were, so now they can say, well, they just killed these people. But, you know, they were trying to kill them. So self-defense itself has always been an argument. And I would use that self-defense argument for we as a white race now, that we need to do what it takes because we are in a state of self-defense, trying to keep ourselves from disappearing. And partly it's our fault because we're not, you know, we're not having children like we should, but that has been done to us too, where we just don't, we just don't feel like we have a real home or a real solid basis in the world anymore. Okay. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's all right. I mean, that's fine. But no, I think it was probably, you know, when you just take that one line out of there, you know, out of the whole, because supposedly it came from an audio recording, right? It's a transcription of the original German.
Yeah, right? I don't believe in the audio recording, though.
Right. Probably not. But, I mean, if you read the rest of it, it's kind of like, you know, he does explain a little bit in here, supposedly, you know, about what, you know, what it was about. And then you take that one line, and if you take that one line, you just slap it on a message board or in an article, and it's like, okay, you know, they're just going out and just kill them because they think they're going to kill us or something to that effect. You know what I mean? It gives the appearance that, you know, they're evil, 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 when we all know the reason why, you know, Hitler and the National Socialists did what they did, you know, had to do because of the hardships that were brought about on Germany post-World War One and
sound bites, Steve. They just take this one phrase and they've been doing this all along. The Holocaust extermination people do that too, the ones who believe in the extermination. They take a few words said by someone or one phrase, and then they publish that. And that is the proof that such and such took place. But if you put the whole thing in context and you study it, you get a whole different perspective on it.
Right.
And they don't want to do
right.
that. This is what we have to do, though. And real
yeah.
historians
and
do this. But most of the people who've written these Holocaust history books are not historians.
No.
I mean, the Jews.
Well, you know,
the Jews who've written them, they're not. They're mostly not trained historians. And I really do think that while we put down historians for not being, you know, honest and so on and going along with the political correctness, still, I think there's a difference between a trained historian and someone who just starts writing history, you know, because there's something to following certain procedures and rules and so on and knowing how to do that, which is worth something.
If I were ever to write a book, I would want it to be as accurate as possible. You know, I wouldn't want to just throw stuff in there just to fill a bunch of pages. You know, but you know, this thing. You know, I'm getting more frustrated every day listening to these shows because I know it's coming. You know, it's coming. You know, and they keep coming up with these lines. It's like they can't get out of, you know, half the truth. I mean, they're still in half the lie and they're in half the truth. They're acting like, which kind of makes me suspect these people. I'm really suspicious of a lot of them now.
I'm glad you're getting suspicious. Yeah.
And I owe you and Deanna and Veronica for that. You guys have spoiled me. I mean, it's like, I can't wait for you guys to come on, you know, so I can, you know, so I can hear real history, real, you know, stuff with sources and whatnot. And then that gets me going because I want to do it. And then when I see something, I say, oh, no, wait a minute. That doesn't sound right.
Veronica's pretty good. She is pretty good. There's things I disagree with her about. She has a kind of a different basis than I have, and so then she looks at things differently and looks for different things than I do, and so on. But really, she is one of the best to listen to, and get things that are really factual. And she goes into a lot of books. Some of these books I don't think are any good, but I'm probably even more suspicious, like you are, than she is.
She kind of looked at sources. I think she also said that, you know, you have to kind of read both to get, you know, the kind of, you know, both sides, you know, and then, you know, basically that then the alternative one or the not so, the one that doesn't make it under the, you know, the New York bestsellers, you know, that's generally
well,
usually
I,
the one.
I could see reading real historians' work, even if it's slanted,
right.
In my opinion. But I don't see reading some of these like Jim Mars that she was talking about.
I
don't, because if they're gonna, you know, I've heard her say, well, they're you can't depend on everything they say, but some of it is okay. And just like people say that about the radio programs or people's websites. Well, they've got some good stuff, even though some of it's not, you know, is wrong and. Well, what is the point
of
that? I mean, if there's some of it is wrong, I'm not going to trust any of it, really.
Yeah.
Unless it's just honest mistakes. But this is not honest mistakes. This is agendas going on.
Yeah. You know, Carolyn, I'm kind of guilty. I actually bought that book a few years back or whenever it came out, The Rise of the Fourth Reich. Mm-hmm. You know, and, you know, it was kind of like, I don't know, to me it was like a scatterbrain kind of book. You know, it's almost like you're constantly going back to go, okay, well, I discussed this back here, and then it's like, I mean, it was like he was tying fantasy into fairy tale.
That's exactly the way it is. That's very good. I'm glad you said that, because this is what I actually looked it up on. Sometimes I just go to Amazon and I see how much I can read of these books, or I go find them in Google Books and see how much of it I can get, you know, that will give me some idea.
Right.
And I read, I think I was able to read the whole introduction to Jim Marr's Fourth Reich and some other little parts. And that showed me that all this work I've done on the Bush Nazi, this purported Bush Nazi connection, which doesn't exist really. But they do this in these books that are putting that forth, and Mars was doing it. They give a lot of banks and banking connections and so on, and then they leap to something else that doesn't really come from that. But then they won't put it in chronological order either. So that you can follow. Well, first this happened, then this, then that. The bank thing did this, and then 5 years later, some other banking thing happened, and then he goes back, 10 years ago, and then he comes up to the present again. And people are just they want to believe it, and so they say, well, there it is, all in black and white. See, he's proved it. Well, he hasn't done any such thing, and I find that really irritating, and it's hard to talk to people about it.
Yeah, I did it first, and now when I look back and I'm going, since the last year and a half, I'm going, why did I even read that book? I was actually, at points, I was pulling my hair out because it was driving me crazy, and I think I was almost about ready to get a bookmark for every page just so I could, and then put a little note on there so I could go back to it, I mean, it was insane. It was insanity. It was pure insanity, Yeah, you guys spoiled me.
Well, that's good.
It's a good spoil.
Yeah, well, you're getting more discriminating.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think you have to be in this. I've never heard Hitler's name so many times before in my entire life than I have. And it seems to be amping up in the last year or so. And I think it's, because of, some of the, the view, people's perspective on Israel is kind of like, people are kind of getting fed up, with this, especially, the economy kind of helped bring that about. And they're going, hey, wait a minute, you're sending how much money over there?
Yeah, well,
you're not doing anything here?
Yeah, Israel is doing a lot to wake people up about Jewish power. But I'm not satisfied to just talk about Israel and care about the Palestinians, because again, I have really come to think that we need to care about our own people, and if we don't, everything is going to come apart. These other people are not strong enough to stand up to the Jews, and we have to stand up to the Jews, and if we don't do it, if we're standing up for all kinds of other people, we need to stand up for ourselves and get the Jews out of our countries, out of our business altogether, 100%.
Yeah, and I want to fix history.
Yeah, well, that's where I started. That's why I started. I wanted to fix history too, and a lot of people do. So a lot of people are working on it, and I think we've been making, like you've said, I think we've been making a lot of progress. And Frank said he thought there was progress being made. It doesn't take everyone. All it takes is a certain amount, and then the whole mass of people turns over. Have you ever heard of the 100th monkey syndrome?
It sounds familiar, but tell me about it.
Well, that's this, probably most people know about it, but it won't take long to tell it. It's, there was, in some studies, they were studying some monkeys on some island. And then they found that, one monkey learned how to wash his, fruit before he ate it in the, you know, stream there or something. Wash something
right.
That was kind of dirty, you know, then other monkeys started copying him, a few, and they were washing it. And anyway, this is maybe just symbolic, but when it got to the 100th monkey, and there were thousands and thousands of monkeys, you know, there, when the 100th one started doing it, then they all started doing it all at once. You know, it like it went into the consciousness. So if something goes into the general consciousness strongly enough that is new and different, once you reach a certain level of, I can't think of what that's called now, but you know, a certain balance of it, then it goes through the whole consciousness and everybody changes. So we can hope for that, you see. We don't have to convince everybody. A lot of people, they just follow.
Yeah. Is that kind of like looking up? One person looks up and everybody else?
Well, yeah.
You know, has to look up? Or how about the person that stops, you know, and looks at the accident on the side of the road and then everybody does it? You know, and before long, you know, traffic's at a dead stop. I'm still like, come on, it's an accident, okay? You can go home.
Oh, I always want to look at accidents. I always want to look at accidents. I hate it when they rush.
I give them a quick glance, but
you can't because they're out there pushing you forward, and I can understand why. When I'm back there,
yeah.
I don't want people to be looking at it and holding me up. But when I get up there, I want to look and see, but you usually don't have a chance to see much. Oh, well.
I don't want anybody to. All right. Well, I'm not taking up all your time, am I? I want you to get some more stuff so I can listen and learn.
Okay. Well, thanks for calling, Steve.
Well, and I will call again next week, Carolyn.
Okay. All right.
Okay. You have a great evening.
Things. Thank you. You too.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, I don't know if anybody else is on the line. That's an old one. That's an old caller. He's not giving me any new messages. So, we're almost to our break time. And I want to mention here, let's see, what will I go to? Well, we've been talking about the Third Reich and the Nazis and so on. So I'll go to this very interesting editorial, I think it was, called On Britain's Nazi Obsession. And I won't finish this. Maybe I will. It was in The Guardian, and it was someone named Simon, I think, if I've got the right one here. And he writes about the extraordinary the extraordinary obsession that the Brits seem to have for the Nazis, because they're always, of course, in the press, they're always writing about the Holocaust or the evils of the Nazis and so on. And they do that on their TV and on BBC. And here now, this British guy is writing. He says, I just took these two paragraphs out of that article. What is extraordinary is that the use of the Third Reich as an all-purpose metaphor for evil extends to every area of culture. He's talking about culture in Britain. The sculptors and the Chapman brothers, there's a couple of creepy painters, supposedly, seem to derive some artistic drive from Nazism. Theater directors feel obliged to pump up Richard III, Macbeth, even Hamlet's Denmark, by depicting them in 1940s Germany. The parallel has gone beyond cliched to seem obsessive and shows no sign of relenting. Only football supporters seem at last to have moved on. Then he says, only insecure nations should rely on creating memorializing necessary enemies, as Britain appears to do with Nazism. Only frightened people seek sustenance from ancient rivalries and past victories. At present, Germany has significance in European affairs unprecedented in peacetime. This is due to that country's economic strength and requires a remarkable generosity towards the other people of Europe. The resentment of the embattled Greeks is already palpable, even as they demand that German banks go easy on their loans and German taxpayers go heavy on their subsidies. Well, I'm going to make some comments about this when we come back from our break. And I find that I don't take this just at face value, what he's saying here. I think there's more to be said about it. And I will remind you that the phone calling numbers are
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Eurozone leaders are preparing a rescue plan to prevent the escalation of the financial turmoil threatening to send the global economy back into recession. This comes as the IMF has warned it may not be able to help out bigger European economies struggling to tackle their debt. With a Greek default now widely considered just a matter of time, the priority is to keep bigger states like Italy and Spain from being dragged down. Greece has been hit by another wave of protests against government austerity measures, but as RT's Gainage Chikian reports, the IMF is accused of being too tough on some countries while being too soft on others, like the U.S., where the crisis began in 2008.
The leadership has changed, but the methods have not. For a desperate economy, the IMF still offers the same bitter medicine of draconian budget belt tightening. Greece is pushed to redouble its austerity efforts at a time of deep economic recession and to sell a vast chunk of public assets at fire sale prices.
Some have no choice but to cut deficit now.
The IMF's former head, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, said that forcing Greece to pay back its debts would unacceptably impoverish the country, and that everyone must be willing to accept losses on Greek debt. But philanthropy has never been the IMF's strong point.
It's an institution where my main shareholder is the United States of America. While any dollar, any euro that is invested in the fund goes back to the member, principal and interest. We're not in the business of subsidies. We're not in the business of giving grants.
The U.S. and Europe are holding the most votes in the organization and veto power, despite the fact that emerging economies have been the engine of global growth in recent years. The organization's policymaking has been under fire for being biased in favor of its top shareholders. One of the functions of the IMF is crisis warning and prevention. But when 3 years ago the financial crisis in the U.S. was sending devastating shockwaves throughout the world, the organization proved completely redundant.
In the case of the United States, the IMF should have taken a much stronger position, warning about the buildup of financial excess in the private economy, dangerous collateralized debt obligations, the housing bubble, completely dropped the ball on that. And unless the IMF is able to monitor the rich and powerful countries like the United States, as well as other countries, it will totally lose its credibility.
Some experts see the intimacy between the IMF and U.S. corporations as a matter of concern.
All of the big decisions at the IMF are made by the U.S. Treasury Department.
Well, even the head of the World Bank has accused the top advanced economies of hypocrisy in their policies.
When countries with large fiscal deficits preach fiscal discipline to poor countries, what are they really saying? Do what I say, not what I do. When countries pay homage to free trade but hold back developing countries with barriers, what are they really saying?
We'll be right back.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. We are in our last half hour, and Leslie is on the phone. Hello, Leslie.
Because you had spoken a while ago about the Austrian people and the Norwegian people being a little bit crazy. I haven't been to Austria, but I did spend some time in Norway quite a while ago. And
well, you know, Leslie, I was speaking in terms of, I don't mean that they're really crazy. I was saying
right.
They're doing crazy things. And as far as the Austrians go, they have laws which force them. And the Norwegians just have their kind of traditions against the Germans. But anyway, go ahead. And
right. What I found when I was a young person when I was in Norway at that time, and I would talk to young Norwegian people, and they all had the same version of what America was. America was a place where we are all basically slave owners with Ku Klux Klan, and we beat up black people and make slaves out of them, impoverish them, treat them terribly. Whip them around and this sort of thing. This is what they all thought. And I
really?
Was trying, yes. And I was trying to tell them, it doesn't work that way, guys. If I go into a black neighborhood in America where I live, I get beat up.
Mm-hmm.
If they come into our neighborhood, nothing happens to them. I said, you people have it all wrong. And they didn't believe me. They thought that I was, you know, giving them some sort of disinformation. So I think that, you know, I think the point that you're trying to make earlier about the Jewish media, I mean, I have to think that they own basically all of the major news outlets, not only in the United States, but in Europe as well. And that's kind of their central point most of the time, is to teach Gentiles that they're evil.
Well, there's also something very liberal and universal type of thinking, it seems like, in the farther north countries, in the Scandinavian countries, let's say, then where you go to the southern part of Europe, like in Spain and Italy, they're not that way at all. So, and for our purposes, they have a better attitude. There's something wrong with these Scandinavians in that they're so open to everyone, to these super liberal ideas, and they're the ones who also have developed the most the biggest welfare states. I mean, their welfare as Haas related is incredible. I mean, you just get everything.
Part of the reason why they're so gullible is because, okay, where I lived in Norway at that time, I mean, they had never seen any foreigners. You know, there were mm-hmm. some in Oslo, but where I lived, there weren't. So they can believe anything because they have no experience with it. So I just saw a thing on the internet about a Norwegian young lady. She had a little kid, and she and her husband decided to move to a school district in their town, which had some Muslims in the town, in maybe 15 or 20% of the town. Well, it turns out, you know, if 15 or 20% of the town are Muslims, that means that 100% of the kindergarten class is Muslim. Well, she found that out, and she thought it would be wonderful for her son, because she had grown up believing, as all Norwegians do, that their biggest problem is lack of diversity, and that with exposing her son to diversity would, you know, enhance his education and such. Well, turned out, you know, he's the only non-Muslim kid in his kindergarten class, and he was beaten up every single day. And, aww, you know, she just couldn't understand this. She just thought, how can this possibly be? Well
that's what Haas was saying, that they don't get it. You see, now her own son is being beat up, and these things are happening, And they still don't want to get it because their idea that everybody is the same, I guess. They have no experience, obviously, with peoples.
I mean, she figured it out. The little boy, every day she would try to go out and play after school in the alley there where they lived, and he would just get beat up, so he finally quit. He was a very depressed little child. So finally she figured it out, you know, she figured it out actually quite quickly and pulled, and they moved out of that school district. But, I mean, this, to her, was just so shocking. You know, she'd been educated through the media in Norway, you know, that the problem with Norway is just too many white people. And, you know, that's the whole problem. And as soon as you bring more diversity in, everything will be fine. And she grew up believing that. It's like all these Norwegians did. Like I said, when I was a kid and I was trying to tell them, no, it doesn't work that way. You don't get a nicer city when you bring a bunch of black people into it, or Arabs or whatever, and they just didn't believe me. Well, now I guess they finally figured it out, because the immigration is just literally destroying, you know, some of the cities
do you think they're going to do something about it before they are too far over the line? I mean, they're probably too nice to ask these people to leave.
Well, the problem is the government. They have no control. In Norway or Sweden, those people have absolutely no say. The government completely runs the show. And the government just says, listen, it's diversity, you like it or lump it. I mean, you have no choice.
Well, you think it's more so in Scandinavia, those governments, than in, say, central, in Germany, France, and Great Britain?
Berlin is having a huge problem, Carolyn, with this.
Oh, I know. And it bothers me a lot. Now, last week there was circulating a story very similar to what you just told us in Germany, that there was this school in a suburb of Berlin that had only three German children still in it. And there was a picture of these three white kids. And all the rest of the school was Turkish or something. Turks, I guess. And maybe a few other things. But... now the difference between the Norwegians and the Austrians is that I know the Austrians do not like all of the immigration and all the immigrants in their country, but they're afraid to say so because of their World War II history and experience, you know. So they have to keep quiet, or they're called racists and so on, and people really mean it, and they're afraid of that. So, but they don't like it, whereas I think that the Scandinavians thought they liked it. But I hope that they learn pretty quick to change their mind.
Okay, Carolyn, I'll let you get your other callers and back to your original subject.
Okay, thanks, Leslie. That was a good call.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, I don't think there are any more callers on the line. I have not been notified of any, so... I will finish up what I was talking about Britain's Nazi obsession and the Simon Jenkins, who is saying that they need to drop all this. This has been going on too long, and they need to quit having this enemy and turning everything into Nazism. Every historical enemy that they've ever had, they want to update it and put it in a modern setting the 1930s and 40s. But I don't fully agree with this guy, because I think what he wants to do is put it all to rest, but it's going to remain the way it is. And, you know, Steve said he wants to fix history. Well, I have that desire too. I don't want to leave the history the way it is. And I'm sure the British do want to leave history the way it is. And so, I would say that we want to correct the record, and this is not what the Britons want. And this is, I think, why they're so insecure about it, why they keep pushing all this Nazi stuff and try to keep all this belief alive, because they greatly fear having this record corrected and putting themselves in a more truthful light instead of the kind of light that they've got. And this, and the United States and Russia are the same. All of them are very afraid of the truth about World War II and the you know, leading up to it and following it and everything that's been going on. And they also, Jenkins makes a big deal about they want Germany to keep supporting Europe. You see, they don't want to antagonize Germany too much. They say, let's not keep after all this Nazi stuff, because we want Germans to be happy Europeans, because they are the workers and they're the ones who make all the economic progress and money and so on. And so we want them to keep supporting us. And that's basically what's going on. The whole thing irritates the heck out of me. Let's see. I might have a... he just says give the number again. Okay, I will give the call-in number again. It is 1-855-477-2283. And if you'd like to call in and chat with me just a little bit, I would welcome you to do that. Let's see. Next up is... maybe I will try to sum up a little bit. This gets a little touchy, but I don't want to lose my nerve. I've been doing pretty well up till now. Why the most important thing is race, and it is I think everything we talked about tonight illustrates what I talked about, what the callers have talked about, illustrates why this race thing has to be very clear cut, because if it's not, we will never get free of that which keeps us. You know, we white people just don't have the strength, the ability to turn their back on people who are less well off than they are, or struggling and can't do as well. And this is to our own detriment. And we found this. Certainly in modern times, we're finding this to be causing us to just about deteriorate. Well, is there a caller? Let's see. Is there a caller?
Yeah, I'm here.
On the line? Oh, okay. Hi.
Yes. Hi, Carolyn. I'm actually on your list. My name's Carolyn. I was wondering if you think maybe Eric Hunt might ever come back on your show. I mean, I really like the work that he's done. I mean, he's a really good person, you know?
Oh, he is a good person.
He's exposed to a lot of good stuff.
Well, that's a possibility. Eric and I have had our differences here and there, and I suppose I'm not the easiest person to get along with. And, so we've been just a little bit estranged, but we've had some little steps of making up recently. And this is John, right?
Yeah.
John, yeah, I know who you are, John.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not, more and more, I am not too much into just doing interviews, just to interview people. There's too much I want to say, and I have my own ideas about things. And I want to have people on to if I think that there's something that they have to impart that I can't impart, or that is, you know, really important that I think is important, and something that would really enlighten the viewers. But I don't just invite people on because I'm looking for someone to interview, you know, like, and particularly since I'm only on once a week.
Right. I know that you'd had him on before.
Yes, I have, though. They were good. I think my last interview with Eric was one of the best interviews Eric ever had.
Oh, so yeah, it was great.
It was very fantastic. Good.
Yeah, it was.
And I will certainly consider that. There's a lot of interesting people. Is that all you wanted to say?
Oh yeah, and keep up the good work.
You'd like to hear more from Eric than you do, huh?
No, I just like to hear how things are going with him. I mean, you know, he went through a lot of hell, you know, because of his you know, his
yes,
stance
he has.
At all.
And, you know, Eric can always call in. I've told some people who would probably rather be a guest on the program that they are free to call in during this hour. And, you know, we could talk about whatever they wanted to talk about. So Eric is free to call in, and I certainly welcome him to do so, to give us any updates or, you know, information about what he's doing. People don't always like to do it that way, but anyway, I do.
Right. Well, I mean,
okay.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Thank
Keep
you,
up the
John.
Good work.
Yeah, all right.
Bye-bye.
I'll try. Bye-bye. Here's... It is kind of hard when you go back and forth in things, and then I'm not sure if I want to get into something or not. I was emailing with Mike Delaney of ProThink this past while ago, and he is interested in coming on and talking about race, and he's got his own very good radio programs. We should just all get together and talk about some of these things. He would like to talk about, what is it here? Well, I don't even have it written down here. Left propaganda and its disinformation agents. This baseless talk about Adolf Hitler as a Zionist. I think that's what it was he was wanting to talk about. But I don't have that particularly written down here. Okay, but he's got a very good program. He's got a very good website. And I would highly recommend that. He is also the creator of the video, long movie video, called about 9/11, titled Missing Links. Now back to Elie Wiesel. I think I'll just end with Elie Wiesel here, where I started, because, you know, Elie, it's very important to me the work I'm doing with Elie Wiesel, and I just tonight spoke to you at the beginning of the show whether it would make any difference, even first time I've even really considered this, whether it would make any difference if Elie Wiesel was entirely exposed as a liar who was not in Auschwitz and was not in Buchenwald. And yet, I'm wondering, if people would accept that all in all and, say, well, but he still suffered and he still wrote all these books and he's still a great man, because people think he's a great man, even though he's not. He's been a supporter of Israel all his life. And he's never done anything great really, except for the show of it. You know, to show he talks a lot about Darfur, and he wants to put our attention on Africa, and he wants Americans and white people to think they need to take care of these African problems. And this is what I was talking about, and he fits the bill perfectly with that. That's an agenda. It's all an agenda with him. He is not a good man or a great man. He is totally he is a prototypical Jew. He doesn't hide that. And he wants only what's good for Jews, but he pretends like it's going to be good for everybody. Now, he was recently in Charleston, South Carolina. And this he was there. I figured out. It didn't take much to figure this out from the newspaper articles, which I read online, of course, that he was given an honorary doctorate of humane letters by the College of Charleston. Can't be very big. It's not like the University of South Carolina or something. But the College of Charleston, because a Jewish businesswoman and philanthropist named Anita Zucker obviously gave a lot of money to the College of Charleston and said she would like them to invite Elie Wiesel to give a speech and bestow on him this honorary doctorate. And so they did. And so he was there and he gave a speech, and he also went through some kind of question and answer process, but that took place a week before his speech. So I don't know what that was all about. he didn't say anything new anyway. But in his speech, he titled it, "Thou Shall Not Stand Idly By," which is what he always says. His whole thing is always indifference, right? That people are indifferent and not doing something about fixing the world. Now, I have learned, and I hope you have learned or are learning, that there's no way to fix the world. You can't fix these people. You know, we as white people are not responsible for what non-white people do and what they don't do and cannot do or whatever. Of course, I know that we have been taking advantage of these people, but it's not all of us. It's these elites. And many times the Jews are in running that, but I'm not going to blame it all on Jews because white elites have been doing a lot of damage. That's true. And I don't approve of that. And I don't think most of you do. So, but I'm not going to be guilty and say that somehow we owe them everything because of that, because most of us didn't do it and didn't participate in it now and didn't gain from it either. But he talks about how in this speech, humiliation is the greatest sin, he says. And he talks about the humiliation of the other. This is another one of his themes, the other. He's saying, you know, don't be afraid of the other and don't humiliate the other, which he's always referring that back to what was done to the Jews. You know, the Jews are the quintessential other, and anybody else who's other, we're supposed to make friends with them and make up with them and not do anything bad to them. But it doesn't matter, it seems, what they do to us. I don't believe in the other anymore. I've shaken all of that off, and I think we all need to shake it off. And we need to quit feeling sorry for the whole world and realize that people are what they are, and there's nothing we're going to do about it. And we need to look after our white societies, our white lands, and we need to get control of them again. And then we do more good for the rest of the world that way than we will ever do by running around, weakening ourselves, letting the Jews run us around in these meaningless efforts to help people. So he says that we need to understand the other, those who are unfamiliar. No, we don't. No, we don't need to understand the other. We need to understand ourselves and look after ourselves and do what we do best. The more unfamiliar a culture or religion is to people who think like Elie Wiesel, the more we're supposed to welcome it and into our midst and how we can learn to understand it. This is the mistake the Scandinavians made. They had never had these people in their midst, and they were feeling very terrible about it. They thought, it's awful to just, we just, all these white people here, we need to get some colored people in here, and we'll have a better society. Well, Leslie already went through that, but it's true that it doesn't work. It does not work that way. You know, I grew up thinking that, in part, well, first I didn't even think about it, but then in part that just all a bunch of white people, all the people I knew and everything, that was just boring. I was looking for something more exciting. Well, I don't think it's boring. It's not boring. It's not at all boring. There's a tremendous diversity, as a matter of fact, among whites, and almost more than we can handle. But there's certainly plenty of diversity, and that's even dealing with our own diversity. Among whites is plenty to deal with, plenty of other there that we don't, and there's even various forms of religion, but not the other major religions, at least, really. So we don't need to add more to that, and we don't need to study the other and bring the other in and understand. That's the Jews' agenda. We know that. That's no secret. So what do we want to do? We want to realize that there's nothing wrong with being with our own race and culture, marrying someone from our own race and culture, and we don't adopt children from other races and cultures. Everybody who I know who's ever done that has not been a good experience. I've never heard anyone say that it was. So there's some things we just have to learn. All these things we have. We have been in this super liberal Marxist, cultural Marxism, syndrome or something, for a long time now, but not long historically. But I think we have, enough of us have come to see that this is not the way to go. And as we become more firm in that, we will influence others until there is that 100th monkey thing. And the whole mindset changes. So thank you for listening tonight. Come back next week. Good night for now.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.